It's August 19th, 2018, and it's your episode 160 of At Percussion. I'm your host, Casey Cangelosi, and we have a full house of co-hosts today, starting with Laurel Black.
Hi.
And Megan Arnes is here.
Hello.
And joining us as a guest co-host again is Brian Nosny. What's up, Brian?
Hey, hello.
Brian, how about a quick LaCroix meme?
Oh, let's see. Let's see. We'll go with one of those ones. I gotta find a better one. LaCroix tastes like the only soft drink they'd allow in a dystopian future where no one is allowed to have emotions.
That's good. That's good. Okay, we'll get more of those along the way. If anybody
Ouch.
feels like a LaCroix meme, just ask Brian.
I like LaCroix. It's good.
I know, no, I like it too, but these are just really, really funny. Also here is Ben Charles. What's up, Ben?
I do not like LaCroix. That's what's up.
Oh, do you not? Okay.
It's so good.
Oh, it's like
These memes
fine,
are for
but
you.
these are really funny. You know what, Brian, why don't you just give us one more since we're
Let me find Okay. This is a little bit disgusting one. Sorry. LaCroix tastes like someone ate a fruit salad and then burped into your water bottle.
Oh,
Sorry. It was just the next
no.
one on the list. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
I'm
You're doing your job.
offended.
You're just doing the job you're asked to do. It's
That's
quite
right.
right. Well, you guys, before I introduce our fantastic guest, I have a little sound segment just to kind of, introduce the sad news that happened in the music world this week. So if you know what this sound is, please let us know. So, anybody happen to know the name of that drum groove?
Steve Gadd?
Steve Gadd, the drummer?
Any, it's just called Steve Gadd.
It's just called Steve Gadd.
Is it the Pretty Shuffle?
Wow, way to go, Ben. Yeah,
Yeah.
I thought someone might have got it. Yeah, way to go, Ben. That is definitely.
Brian actually wrote a piece about it. No, but Brian.
Nice, nice, nice. But
Yeah.
I thought you'd
Never
eventually maybe get to Bernard Purdy. So, you guys, yeah, this is the Purdy Shuffle coined by Bernard Lee Purdy. And so, anyway, real quick about him, born June 11th, 1939. He's an American drummer, considered an influential and innovative funk musician. He is known for his precise musical timekeeping, his signature use of triplets against a halftime backbeat, which is that Purdy Shuffle. And what you were listening to was yours truly recording it about 20 minutes ago before we started. He was inducted into Modern Drummers Hall of Fame in 2013. He can be heard on 4,000 recordings, many of which are with who we lost just a few days ago, the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. So, yeah, just a few. Look, there's so much good information out there on Aretha Franklin. I'm certainly no person who's can add anything unique to any of that, but I thought it might just be fun to just run down some quick, cool facts about Aretha Franklin. So she died just a few days ago at 76 from pancreatic cancer in her home in Detroit. She released the song Respect when she was only 25 years old. And that song, in addition to being hugely popular, it became an anthem for civil rights and feminism. She had about a 4-octave range at her peak, going from G2, which is the lowest staff line on the bass clef, G2 all the way up to E6. She released 42 studio albums and sold 75 million records worldwide. She toured with Martin Luther King Jr. She appeared on the cover of Time magazine the year after Respect was released in 1968, and when she was only 26 years old. One fun thing I read, she was notoriously afraid of flying after a turbulent flight in 1980, after which she never flew again for 30 years. I thought that was really
Wow.
I thought that was really cool. It's like, I don't like this thing. it makes me nervous. I'm not doing it. And I'm in control enough of my career that I don't have to do it. So she's notorious for having shown up on buses and taking buses really long distances. She won 18 Grammy Awards, has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and was the first woman inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She received a Presidential Medal of Freedom and, of course, many, many other honors and awards. So anyway, I know this will be old news by the time this podcast is released, but I thought it'd be cool just to click off a few cool things about her that you might not have known.
In addition to that business about her not flying, I also read about how even when she was extremely established in her career, she always demanded she had to be paid in cash at the venue, I think, before she went on, because she'd gotten ripped off so many times. And so, yeah, they would have like an armed guard that they would hand the cash off to. And yeah, that's crazy. I mean, but you know, we've all been screwed over in gigs. We know how that goes. So
one other thing about Aretha, random thing, is the fact that her, her first album, I believe, was cut in Alabama at Fame Studios up in Muscle Shoals, which is a famous, famous recording studio.
Cool. Okay.
Well, you guys, today's guest, he teaches music composition theory, songwriting, and orchestration as an associate professor of music theory and composition at Westchester University. He's just got a beautifully unique compositional voice, many, many popular pieces for percussion, and they seem to just keep coming. You know, I hear lots of people talking about this composer all the time. It seems like he's always popping up on social media, and people are just always talking about Adam Silverman. How's it going? Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's fun to be on.
Yeah, sure. So how has your summer been? What have you been up to?
I have been very, very busy this summer. I travel a lot. I'm a Suzuki parent, which is, I think, the hardest job in the world.
Whoa.
So I go around and go to Suzuki festivals where my wife teaches and my children are enrolled. And then when I'm at home, I'm frantically working on, I had three new commissions this summer, and they, have kicked me in the butt, but I'm working my way through them and I'm excited about them.
So Adam, I was checking out some of the pieces that you sent us, and I came across the piece that you wrote for the X4 Quartet, and on the YouTube sort of side videos was another one of your pieces you wrote for the Quaid Duo. And the thing that kind of struck me about both pieces was the instrumentation was so unique. And I think that you could study composition and orchestration in school all day long, but when someone asks you to write a piece for that includes tabla and steel pan, or the sort of very unique instruments in that Quaid piece, I just can't fathom how a composer, even a percussionist composer, would wrap his mind around that. Could you explain sort of your process for figuring out what to do with those strange instruments?
Yeah, thanks. That's actually a kind of a funny thing to put those two pieces together, because one of them, the Quaid piece, was something that I had sky's the limit to sort of compose whatever instruments I wanted, and so I got to choose those instruments. And the X4 piece was one where they said, very specifically, Julie wants to play, this was for the, Julie Hill wanted to play steel pan. And Dan Piccolo, who was there at the time, wanted to play tablas. And G.K. Jung really wants to play marimba, that's her thing. And they wanted to have, so they very particularly wanted to have a piece, marimba, vibraphone, tabla, steel drum, and said go forward with it. So it was terrifying to write for tabla, and I spent a lot of time looking at online. You know, I'm not a percussionist, and so I don't know how to play any of these instruments. I did study marimba for one semester in graduate school. That was a lot of fun. But so I learned most of my techniques of composing for percussion instruments by watching instructional videos on YouTube. I watch people playing them, talk about the strokes and whatnot, or doing solos. And for tabla, there are these amazing intricacies that you can really do. And they terrified me. And I decided in the end that I would avoid all of them and just trust Dan, who's such an amazing player. And he said to me right at the beginning, he said, we want this piece to have legs. And I know that very few people play tabla. So if you want to, you can write a sort of a hand drum part and I'll make it a tabla part. So in the end, I had written a piece many years ago called Naked on Fire, which was for, among the other instruments, Rick and Dumbek, and I had them basically notated the same way. So in the end, I notated the doublet part basically like I had notated those. And then he crafted this amazing thing that has all the whoopsie things and wonderful glisses, and he made it sound just extraordinary. He's such a great player. The steel pan, I looked at a lot of, I did the same sort of, took a way out. I looked at a lot of steel pan music. I really enjoyed it. And I remember having a great fondness for steel pan music when I was a student in Miami, and they had such a vibrant sort of pan ensemble at my school. And I thought, you know, that's not what I want to do. And so I took a pan home from my school, Westchester University, and I started hitting it with sticks and doing all sorts of other things. I sampled it, and I made those samples work into a functional part. So it's actually like the least steel drum piece, I think, because it's really more just like a, almost like a kit piece. It works very pattern-based. And so instead of working on really figuring out what pitches I wanted, I almost more figured out what motions I wanted and composed those into the piece. So that was a lot of fun. The Quay piece is a piece called Paper Covers Rock, which I had gone to, like I said, I'm a parent, and I had gone to a third birthday party where they had a musician there, and he had all of these wonderful toys that are these spinning bells. And I just loved him. So I bought one, and I socked it away for the day when I could play with it or compose for it. And Gene Kaczynski had posted online not that long before I started composing this piece, this series of hand, oh, they're like handbells, but they're triggered like hotel bells. And they're by, they have the same colors, but they're actually by a different toy manufacturer. And they fit perfectly. And so I thought, and there's this adorable thing with his little daughter putting her hand in the video to play them. So I thought, wow, these will go great together. So I bought a set of those bells. And, well, I bought two sets of the spinning bells and this big chromatic set of the hand bells. And composed for that, among other instruments, and the whole sort of percussion battery of it. So that was one that I was just inspired to do. And the other one was, they said these instruments and go find a way to work it out.
Do you find that, I know a lot of the time composers talk about how limitations can be helpful in sort of forcing your creativity. Did you find that the limitations of one of those pieces was helpful, or that the freedom of the other wasn't, or kind of a washer?
Well, that's it really depends on the limitation for me. So, like, I'm very sort of tied up in knots if someone asks me to write a piece that has to have a certain kind of spirit to it, or that has to have maybe some instruments that I'm not excited about. But in this case, it was they were the right kind of limitations. And for the X4 piece, I think that really worked out well in the end. I was very happy for it. I had another limitation of that piece that I really liked, which was not from them, but from me. I decided to play with a sort of a weird hexatonic scale. So a hexatonic scale is, or at least this one, is. It sounds like this. It's a minor third followed by a half step. And so it's like an octatonic scale that's whole half, but this is... Wait, did I skip it? And so I... Yeah, well, it's very cool because it has these, it has a major chord and a minor chord and an augmented chord. And you can kind of move into this major sort of first inversion figure or the bluesy kind of figure. So it worked out great. It was really fun. So the marimba and the vibraphone use that almost exclusively. And the steel drum harmonizes with it in a way that's comfortable for the playing of the hands. And so there was a little freedom, there's a little limitation, and it worked out really well. For the Quay piece, I really started to open up in that piece and saying, I don't want to call for this specific instrument or that specific instrument, because I knew as great as my imagination might be for that piece, the instruments that... that Gene owns are better than what I could imagine. And so I could have opened it up, because he just has a stunning collection. So I just opened it up in a big way and let him choose some instruments And then I had a trip to Minnesota where I worked with him on it. And it turns out that all of his choices were like the best choices. They were really fantastic. And there was very little sort of messing around we had to do with that one.
Yeah, so, there are worse people you could write a piece for than Gene, I'm sure.
And I knew that about him, and I knew I could trust him.
Mm-hmm. Well, Adam, I think it also says a lot that of you trusting the performer by leaving parts open-ended. And you know, as you know, we played Spiderweb Lead last year, and I thought it worked out really well, the hand, quote unquote, hand drum part that was meant for a tabla.
You did it on congas, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We had the guy who played it is from Costa Rica, and he's played a lot of Latin music. And so he, felt the most comfortable on congas. And it was fun to work with him on that part because you kind of left it open ended in a, you know, with the sounds, at least not with the rhythms. I don't know. It just allowed for more creativity. And I think, you know, for instruments that are typically taught by rote anyway, it's difficult, even if you were a tabla master or a conga master or congera or whatever, to write something out in such great detail, because in a lot of cases, you know, there is improvisation open for the performers. So in a way, it feels a little bit restricting if it's an instrument that is taught orally anyway. So I don't know. I thought that was effective. And I think a lot of people get scared of that and don't write for those instruments because of that. But I think that yours is a great example for of a way to do it that's not restricting and still has a lot of guidance as to what the player should play.
Thank you. You know, it's funny. I got this weird feedback a couple years ago. Sam Solomon wrote this next edition of his How to Compose for Percussion book. Mm-hmm. And he used my piece, Naked on Fire, in it as a sort of example of improvisational techniques composed into music, which is something I had not really considered that I was doing. Mm-hmm. But now that he pointed that out, that's become a way, something that informs the way I compose. And okay. I like that idea. And so when I am writing rhythm parts like that, that's essentially what I'm doing, is I'm sort of doing a notated improvisation. And it's not a problem for me if people actually do improvise in those parts. In the last couple of pieces or a couple of recent pieces, I've started to loosen up a little bit, and I've started to write some improv sections and kind of guide it. Maybe there'll be four bars of improv, or maybe there'll be a groove that has fills that a person can add and just do those things that are really sort of standard things that drummers have been doing all along. But it took me a while to kind of get open to it. Mm-hmm. So that's been a lot of fun.
Cool.
Adam, you and I have talked before about, I think if I remember the conversation right, I asked kind of like, what are you first thinking of when you're writing? And the first thing you said was texture. Mm-hmm. Does that end up becoming difficult for you when you're then saying, well, I'm going to write for tabla, but it could really be kind of more a hand drum open it. Like when you keep it open-ended like that to a point, does that help you or hinder you when you're then thinking about texture like that?
That is kind of a weird piece. First of all, because it's a quartet, it's not a ton of instruments to build little like layered textures for. And so that piece is really a marimba and a vibraphone that are always coordinated, or almost always coordinated, except when there are vibraphone solos in the piece. And then there's a bit of a rhythm part from the, certainly throughout from the tabla, and a kind of rhythm part for the steel drum as well. So I don't get the chance to really layer and work on crazy colors in that piece. Mm-hmm. So I'm relying on more of a chamber music aspect for it, but I've enjoyed lately. I've gotten to write. I just finished writing a big ensemble piece, a 10-player piece for Indiana University that's going to premiere at PASIC this year. And Those are the pieces that I just love thinking about, these really big textures where you've got three or four or five people on a layer, and they can really all contribute to a massive sound. That's the stuff that I feel like I end up happiest with.
It's called Pounding Face, right?
Pounding Face, yeah. That's the new piece.
Well, I had a question when you're talking about the hexatonic scale, and we're talking about using these unique instruments. It reminded me, the hexatonic scale reminds me very much of Messiaen and his scales of limited transposition, that sort of thing. What, I guess my question is, like, what would you do if someone wanted you to write a piece that used non-Western scales, like something that had, you know, very, you know, quarter tones, Harry Parch instruments, something like that? Would you still approach them as a regular scale? And what would be your, I don't know, what would be your vibe toward that?
Well, you're asking the right guy for that. I started out, when I was an undergraduate, I became very, very interested in microtonality, especially just intonation microtonality. And I went to study, you mentioned Harry Parch, I actually went after college, before graduate school, to study with a master of that music, a guy named Ben Johnston, who was a student of Harry Parch's, basically maybe the only student of Harry Parch's.
He's the one that has a piece called Knocking Piece, right?
Right. Yeah. Pesce is no knocking piece. It's hard, right? It's a kind of cage level bonkers mathematical piece almost. But what Ben Johnston did primarily for his career was write music that is in just intonation, perfect tune ratios. He developed a notation to write this stuff, and he used things like the 7th harmonic, the 11th harmonic, the 13th harmonic as just basic units of the music. He went way higher than that, actually. And when I studied with him, I started doing that, and I wrote a string quartet that was on this flexible just intonation scale. And I wrote, a handful of pieces that were difficult to perform from people who had to learn that kind of style and learn how to listen differently. And I loved it. It was fascinating. And in the end, what I found was it was an extremely unfriendly way to be a musician, like to be a composer and to go into the room and say, you know what I want you to do? I want you to learn a new kind of notation and learn a new way to listen. And I'm going to have to teach you a lot about how to play music before you play this thing. And then what is the performer do is they're completely hamstrung usually by the demands of this music that they can't just be the great musicians that they are. So in the end, what I did was say that was a fun thing to do for a while, and I'm going to kind of give it up. I did actually go hear the Harry Parch Ensemble last year, the West Coast Parch Ensemble. I guess they're both West Coast Parch Ensembles now. The California Parch Ensemble. And had a nice offer from the director of that group, a guy named John Schneider, to compose a piece for them. And if you had asked me 30 years ago, like, would I ever turn down an offer to write for the Parch Ensemble, it would have been bonkers. But it would have just boggled my mind. But in the end, I decided, that was just not something that I am sort of capable of participating in right now.
Is that just the time that you would need to get back in that mindset?
Well, I know how to do it. I know what the instruments do, and I know how all the pitches are laid out on his instruments. I actually have charts and tables. When I was a student, I actually transcribed a lot of his music into Ben Johnston's notation so that you could read it as pitches instead of as tablature. Whew. And talk about like crazy hours of labor. But I loved it, and it was fantastic. And I transcribed some of his music for string quartet. And I think it's possible the Kronos Quartet actually played one of those pieces at one time. But it just goes back to my feeling of writing that music isn't a way of engaging a musical community. It's really just a way of making one piece. So that's not what I'm interested in now. And one of the things that I love about working with college percussion ensembles and writing percussion ensemble music is that I get to do really fantastic things like meet people and have visits at different colleges and coach students and get to know people through them playing multiple pieces, work with them on recordings. To me, this is the joy of music making. And it's something that is impossible when you're writing for a piece like a harmonic canon or a bamboo marimba, or you know, something that there only exists one of them. Mm-hmm. Not that, you know, writing for carousel bells of toys that people have to actually purchase or rent in order to play a piece is 100% there, but it's a much nicer way for me to feel like I'm engaging a community and doing music that is that gives back and is rewarding. So,
well, speaking of pieces of yours, thinking of an older piece that maybe is a little more difficult for the community to swallow, and it's the first piece or one of the first pieces I ever saw Laurel perform, and man, she creeped out everyone in the audience and did such a killer, just knockout performance of your piece, Stars, Cars, Bars. And I just thought, whoa, this chick is really freaky. I'm into this Laurel Black. So I don't know. I'd love to just ask both of you.
Is that what did it for you?
It's like, whoa, she's far out. But yeah, I don't know. I'd just love to ask both of you, like both Laurel and Adam, like what's up with that piece, you know? And maybe Laurel, like what drew you to that piece?
Should we describe it first a little bit?
Oh, please. Yeah, Adam, that'd be great.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you want me to? Stars, Cars, Bars was really the first percussion piece I wrote, actually. It's a marimba solo where the marimba player whispers and shouts and speaks. And it's based on a sort of a misremembered song lyric from Nabokov's book Lolita. And I really loved that book at the time. I actually wrote two pieces based on passages from that book. And it was... this piece, Stars, Cars, Bars, is a sort of minimalist version of a lovely lyric that goes really sour through it. And it goes from a sort of a lovely memory to a murderous rage at the very end. And so I can imagine you like falling in love with Laurel and the lovely things that, and then being like, wait a second here, what is going on?
Wait a minute.
Yeah, right. The line, the gun I'm holding right now at the end, I think is the line. It's like, oh yeah, this is the woman for me.
That's awesome.
Yeah, Laurel, what do you have to say?
I was introduced to your piece in grad school, because a lot of the people in the marimba studio were doing marimba speaking pieces, and the connection was a big one that like all these people were doing, and I wanted to get on that train because I'm a big lover of theater and I loved being involved in it in undergrad. And so
the connection is a different piece, right?
Yeah, the connection is a different piece. And you know, so I didn't want to do one that everybody else was doing, but I really felt like I should do a piece like that. And so then one of my studio mates showed me that piece of yours, and I thought, I'll do this one. Nobody else is doing this one. I'll try this. And I just loved working on it, frankly. And I liked that I got to approach it from a very theatrical perspective. That's what I chose to do. Sorry, there's a baby in my lap.
You're doing good. You guys see why I go to the office? Every episode.
So it was really cool to work on, and I actually, I played it for Nancy, and she was like, whoa, I don't have anything to say. That was cool. Will you do it at my festival? And that's where Casey and I met. I played it for Sam, and it was interesting to perform it a few times for the studio, because I would have people that really loved how I did it one time and then really didn't like it another time. And I think some of the choices that I felt like I needed to make were because I was a girl doing this piece. And I you can correct me if I'm wrong, Adam, but I thought that who you wrote it in mind, or who was in mind when you wrote it, was a guy, which to me paints it slightly differently than if it's the girl, and you know it's based off of Lolita. So I made a lot of choices that I think were, you know, probably pretty troubling to people. But yeah,
that's
really
a very troubling book, and it's especially troubling this year. It's just like the least. It's one of those books that's going to be jettisoned along with all the Woody Allen films. It's just the worst culprit of Me Too misbehavior, which is just a bizarre thing because it's this incredible work of art, and it's a work of art on the level of those Woody Allen films and of the Wagner operas and things that you have to just either swallow the pill and say this is something that you're not taking a stance on, or you have to say there's no more Lolita.
Something Laurel said about transforming the role, gender role, resonated with me because I recently did the same thing with that Diana McIntosh piece, All Too Consuming. It's hard to argue that it's not, it has to be a woman's performer. There's a female voice in the tape playback that's supposed to be your thoughts as the piece is unrolling, and it's a female voice. It's the composer, Diana McIntosh, speaking. But it's I found it to be just like incredibly helpful to say, like, okay, there's this extra challenge of doing this gender reversal, and the voice in my head has to be a female's thoughts, but I'm not trying to be a female. Mm. Also, I think not my first speaking piece, but I've not done many.
Well, I think it probably worked really great when you did it as a woman, and I think that it can totally work that way. And there's something probably like really wonderfully transformative about you doing that, especially because I think the idea of like murderous male aggression is something that is just very strange coming out of a woman's, a woman's mouth, a woman's body. And that must have shocked the hell out of everyone.
Oh yeah, no, it's very, very good. Well, you have some new solo pieces as well. You're doing, right, or that you're working on?
Yeah, I have two. Well, I have two new solos that are done and that I have not yet gotten to hear. So they're just kind of rolling out now. The first one was a piece for drum kit that I wrote for Michael Burrett to play. I think he should do that soon. That one's called Nightmare Machine. And that one is going to be a real oddity. It's he wanted a piece with electronic soundtrack, essentially electronic accompaniment track. And it, I don't work that way. I've not done something like that before. So what I did was thought of the best sounds that I could make really good audio from, which I have a sort of contact library that includes really great retro synth and analog keyboard sounds. Those are way more effective than, for instance, having a computer play something that sounds like a violin or sounds like a real instrument. So I used those samples and I layered them and I made a whole thing that was a fully composed, really, really rocking drum kit part, with this very prog rock sounding electronic accompaniment. And hopefully he'll really groove on that. I think he's gonna probably do it towards the beginning of next year. So we'll hear that soon. The other one is a piece called Downtown is the Battery, which is for a sort of a weird kind of a drum kit. It's actually not a drum kit that is very specifically instrumented, like talking about opening it up to different options. It has instruments called for, like dull thuds, pings, and mid, sort of like dull mid and high thuds, a little different things. Like the idea is that you're playing on things that are completely non-resonant, like buckets and books, and then you amplify them and play it through like a beautiful reverb or something like that. So it sounds like it's made in a big big empty space. And I'm looking forward to hearing that. There are a couple people who are working on it, and hopefully that'll come out soon on SoundCloud or on a CD or something like that. But I'm excited about that piece coming up too. That's just a real open-ended instrument piece, but that has very, very specifically notated rhythm parts, which are on this series of metric modulations. And so there's a sort of foot cabasa pedal that keeps a consistent sort of chicka 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 for a lot of the piece. And then it becomes the, instead of being the beat, it becomes a part of a, you know, a compound meter, because it's a part of a syncopated thing. And it plays against that. A lot like what you do actually with metronomes and things like that, Casey, where it has a steady thing and you're changing the pulse around it.
Hear that, guys? I'm part of the wave.
The waves.
Hey, well, you mentioned for Nightmare Machine, you mentioned prog rock esque and or influence. I was wondering, like, what do you have specific prog rock influences? And then I was going to ask Brian Nosny to tell me his favorite Dream Theater album, because I know he.
I'm not a huge prog rock fan. It's really funny. I really liked writing this piece, and so what I was basing it on was probably most closely resembled like ELO, ELP, all the ELs, maybe some Yes, some sort of roundabout level Yes.
Yes, yeah.
And that stuff was just in my head, and I really enjoyed making it. But it's actually not the music that I go listen to all the time.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, Nosny would be much more the expert than.
Well, assuming Nosny is the expert here, I have a question. Is Rush prog rock?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, just checking. Because sometimes people tell me no, and I think, what are you talking about? No, it's totally prog rock.
No, they would be. There's a whole like new set of classifications within this. So I think they would technically be in what's called proto prog. So, like, that original wave of progressive rock with like Yes and ELP and you know, stuff like that.
But aren't they just part of the lineage? Like,
yeah.
Rush and, yeah, I mean, okay, favorite Dream Theater album?
Images and Words, just their first major commercial release, because after that Kevin Moore left and it just completely changed. Although Awake, their second one, is it's so close.
That's the correct answer.
Is Awake.
Is Awake, yeah. Is Awake.
Can you talk about Game of Thrones some?
We certainly can. Adam, just so you know, I've tried for years to get this crowd to talk about Game of Thrones, and they shoot me down every time. It's
There's a whole episode out there.
That's there true. Is, yeah. For all the hardcore fans, you can find a bootleg online somewhere.
That's true. There is the long-lost episode of myself, Tracy Wiggins, Brian Nosny, and...
This is, by the way, not a joke. This actually exists.
No, yeah, this is no joke. Yeah, yeah. I cut it because I sounded like an idiot, but...
160 episodes. You got to find something to talk about.
It's true. Megan, I think you have a real question there, something of relevance and importance.
Yeah, sure. I just wanted to ask Adam, and I think I know the answer, because I've heard your, you know, I've been familiar with your music for a long time now through John Parks, and I'm just wondering if you could, since you're not a percussionist, how did you start composing for percussion, and like, how did you get interested in our community, and like, when did that start? I'm just curious of the story.
Yeah, thank you. John Parks is a huge part of that. But when I composed Stars, Cars, Bars, I wrote that for I was in graduate school, and I had this amazing department where I was at Yale, and Bob Van Cise had started teaching there just sort of while I was there, and he brought all of these people who are now they're like becoming sort of luminaries in the community. It's really, really stunning. It was the early people, the early incarnation of So Percussion. And Eduardo Leandro is one of my friends there. Paul Fadul is the person I wrote Stars, Cards, Bars for. Mm-hmm. And really, like just a stunning community of percussionists who were, don't tell all the other people at Yale this that I said this, but they were the friendliest people there. They're the people who were willing to do new music and the people who were willing to hang out outside of the, you know, the usual sort of practice room situation. So
yeah,
they were great. I shouldn't forget Tim Feeney was one of the great friends.
Yay.
There. These are like my sort of, you know, childhood friends almost. But so we started writing for percussion, me and my friends, and that piece, Stars, Cars, Bars, sort of rolled around a little bit, and a couple years later, Paul Fadul again asked me if I could write a piece for his percussion quartet, which was something I didn't have any time for, and I was I almost blew it off. It became one of my most sort of like most important pieces to building a career for me, which was a piece called Quick Blood. Mm-hmm. I wrote that for his percussion quartet, which also just had amazing people in it. It was Cynthia Ye and Matt Strauss and Paul, and it was just like these people who went on to do amazing things. Mm-hmm. So Quick Blood had a performance every couple of years for a while, for maybe a decade. And eventually I was somehow contacted by John Parks, who said to me, we want to do Quick Blood here at Florida State, and I've just bought a couple of microphones, and I want to learn how to use the microphone, which was a sweet thing for him to contact me and say, you know, we want to record the piece and do the little thing that composers do now as a matter of course, which is exchange MP3s long distance, and he'll send me a rehearsal recording and I'll get to coach it. He wound up taking that microphone thing extremely seriously. Basically made,
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, this huge career out of, I mean, it's gone into video now, and it's just, I was so lucky in a couple of ways. One is I was so lucky to connect with a musician who wants to do the piece and make these beautiful recordings. Mm-hmm. But also just and to connect with someone like him who he's so dedicated to doing new projects and so friendly and so wonderful about encouraging music in a long way. So John and I became friends, acquaintances from that. And I was writing an opera at the time. I was writing an opera that sort of took a decade of my life to come back to. And eventually I said, well, I just got to finish this thing. And I tabled all other projects. And when I finished it, I didn't have anything to compose. It's just done. And so I thought, well, you know what? Maybe I could compose a piece for percussion and ask John to do it. So, so I contacted him and I said, you know what, I'd like to write you a new piece. Would you let me do that? And he said, well, you know, we, have a CD, I'm making a CD soon. And so if you compose a piece, we'll put it on the CD, which I thought was really a great thing. And he was this, the first person who I had that conversation with about like, what instruments do you want to use? How many players should it be? And it was sort of the sky's the limit. Really amazing. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote him a piece called Gasoline Rainbow. And then a couple of years later, he contacted me, said, well, our group won the chance to play at PASIC. We write a piece for that. And I wrote him another sextet, the Naked on Fire sextet. And over the years, it's just been one thing after another, after another. And I've been the luckiest composer in the world because not only will he have his ensemble play these pieces so beautifully, but he'll record them so beautifully, and I get to share those recordings. And mm-hmm. The other thing, my sort of real big introduction to the percussion community was my own instigation with him. I said, I really want to write a marimba concerto, because I had written a concerto for saxophone and wind ensemble that I really enjoyed doing, and I wanted to write more band music. And I thought, well, this would be a great way to get engaged with some great soloists and to write a wind and marimba piece. So So I asked John if he would be one of the commissioners. And between John and another percussionist, Chris Hanning, who's at my school with me, Westchester, they helped me put together a consortium of commissioners, of people who have now become my friends and my people who I'm doing future projects with. And it's really formed a great sort of social network for me. So it all kind of comes back to these early friendships, first with Paul Fadul especially, and then with John mm-hmm. Parks. So very fortunate.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Community seems to be a really, really important thing that you bring up a lot, Adam.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Is there a question? It's important to me. It's why making music is fun for me and exciting, and I always look forward to doing the next project. Whereas, I remember coming up as a student composer with this feeling that, back then it was the 20th century, right? And 20th century composers, I think, were known for being loners who smoked pipes and complained about how no one understood them. That it's a different world right now. And I think part of that is a spirit of engagement and connection between composers and performers who want to share a goal of making everyone sound good and making everyone have a good time. It's also fun, just one of the things about percussion music that's so strong is the fact that it is really strongly based at colleges. And I haven't gone so much into the high school and middle school world of percussion, but when you're working with college students, there's this wonderful technical level that people have now, just like stunning. So the performances can be very good, certainly better even than a lot of professional performances that maybe don't have the same level of preparation. Mm-hmm. And music gets to be done a lot because there's a freakish amount of wonderful percussion departments in the country, in the world. And so people like to share music and talk about what they've done and so it gets around. And then what I'm seeing now, having composed percussion music for more than 10 or 15 years, is the students who played the music, especially the graduate students at Florida State or wherever, they're out getting jobs and programming music and running their own ensembles. And so there's a wonderful sense of feeding into a culture through people becoming teachers and sharing with their students.
Yeah, and two of those people just commissioned you to write a double concerto, right?
Indeed.
Can you tell us about the rule of five?
Yeah, you want tips because you're playing it in February.
Yeah, exactly.
The rule of five was it was commissioned by Luis Rivera and Justin Alexander, who were both at Florida State. I don't know if they were both there when I composed Naked on Fire. I assume that Justin was certainly there. I guess Luis was in the ensemble.
Yeah, Luis played the maracas part, I think.
He was the maracist. And I was just very lucky. They talked to me the last time I was at PASIC, which was for the premiere of a piece I had written for Troy University, for Nazi's school, called The Cruel Waters. They asked me, they said, we want to have a concerto for our duo, and we'll put together a consortium with some fine players. And they had certain kind of restrictions, like they wanted to have a piece that allowed them to play instruments that they really featured. Justin particularly wanted a part for shakeray. And I ended up writing them a piece that was really open in a lot of ways. Like, instead of just having like a shakeray solo in it, I have these solos that sort of describe, I want something that's an instrument that you can kind of, it's like an unpitched instrument that you can get 5 or 6 pitches out of, or something that is a set of drums or a set of ringing, clacking metal instruments. But so there's a little a hardware store visit that is required to play this piece. And there's a little, there's a lot of choices that can be done. And there's a lot of instruments on stage, but it has a couple of crazy concerto solos that I think maybe haven't been done before. Like there's a sort of massive solo for Mark Tree, which I thought was fun. There was I think I've taken out most of that music that didn't work out too well. The piece starts out with the two players, the two soloists unaccompanied playing an entire movement, a short movement of just for castanets. And that makes, I think, a really great beginning. It just very focuses the attention close down towards the center of the stage. And the piece is in, I think, 5 movements or 6 movements that have a couple of solos and interspersed with the movements where they play with the large ensemble. And my goal for this piece was to try to write a piece where the wind ensemble doesn't just get all the melody while the percussion soloists sound like accompanists. And that's the biggest problem, I think, with percussion concertos, is that there's so much music that the soloists tend to play where they could really just be in the back of the band. So I did my best to avoid that and to really feature them sort of by minimizing the melodic action in the band and maximizing the focus on the and the integrated quality between the two soloists. So I hope it works out really well. They got to premiere the piece a couple times. It's been played a few times already and has a few performances coming up. It's an exciting thing getting to hear people make their artistic choices in the framework of the piece that I composed. Mm-hmm. So I think as the piece is performed more and more, I'll probably want to refine it so that the solo parts are maybe less open in the end, but that feature the best choices that were made by the commissioning partners. And so that way everybody kind of gets to make their stamp on the piece, and it's a lasting stamp.
Cool.
Great. I have a question for Adam and Brian too. I imagine where you're both at in your careers, just kind of one commission after the next. Do you find you're ever finding time to just write a piece you're thinking of? Or, I mean, you know, flashback a decade ago when it was kind of, here's a commission here, but then I'm also just writing pieces for the sake of writing pieces because they're interesting to me. Do those still happen, or is it all just commissions?
Brian, do you want to take that one?
I kind of try and build about 6 months in after a project's done at this point now, to where I go, okay, I've got to do this. It's got to be done by June. So then I maybe take the rest of that year, and at least I try to do whatever it is I want to do. But it's become to the point now where I think I have my commission that I'm working on, or my multiple commissions that I'm working on. And then on the periphery is the other thing that maybe when I said, you know what, I've done my work for the day. I'm going to take an hour now and mess with this thing that I just want to write for me.
Gotcha.
That's kind of how I'm handling it right now, at least.
That's a nice thing.
Adam.
Well, you know, I've been lucky lately that I've been able to write pieces that, really entirely pieces that I want to compose based on some either requests to write it or being able to initiate something. So like I had gone to John and say, I want to write this marimba concerto, let's make it happen. Eventually it kind of comes together.
Right.
I remember thinking that the coolest composer commission, you know, relationship that I'd heard of was from the composer John Zorn. John Zorn was sort of famous for, as I understood it, writing whatever he wanted, and then he puts it out there and says, "Who wants to commission this?" and then someone sponsors it. I don't quite do that, but for the most part, I get to write music that I want to do and find the right partners to play it with.
Cool.
And sometimes people come to me with better ideas than I had, or ideas that I can mull over and say, oh, this would be really nice.
Adam, I'm just curious, was the cello concerto, was that a thing you wanted to write, or was that a Parks idea or your idea or an Amy idea?
And I'm not trying to imply that, you know, a commission means you don't want to write it at all.
Sure.
Of course not. Yeah, no, but the cello concerto, I wrote a piece called the Percussory Insectarium, which is the word "the" and then two words that actually don't exist, and so it's for cello and 10 percussionists. And this was a piece that I was like kind of done writing music that was pure on percussion ensemble music, just because I had done a good handful of those and thought, well, I don't really need more of those right now, and so. When John said he's making the next CD and what's the next project we want to do, I pitched it to him. I said, well, can we do the cello piece? And he said, oh yeah, great. Let's make that happen. He was excited for it. He'd always wanted to work with my wife, Amy, who's a really fantastic cellist. And so we did that. He premiered it and we've recorded it, and it should be edited sometime soon and coming out. I think the CD is going to be named after that piece.
Oh, nice. So,
you'll see a CD from Florida State sometime down the road called the Percussory Insectarium. And so that was one of those examples of Mike sort of bringing something to the table that was, a piece that that I could say, let's do this. And he said, since then, by the way, I've composed like 4 percussion ensemble pieces with no non-percussion instruments. And one of the biggest challenges of this summer is that I had written, I was commissioned to write a piece for Truman State University, where I'm going to have a sort of residency coming up this November. And I started writing that, and I got a commission from Indiana University to write this piece for them to play at PASIC. So I had to very quickly use up all of my ideas for Truman State, and then come up with a whole new set of ideas to start the next day writing a piece for Indiana. Both had really tight deadlines. So what I wound up doing was something that I really love. So I wound up making a piece for Indiana that is a synthesis of all of my favorite techniques from pieces that I have written over the last couple of years. And so it sort of poaches from the piece I wrote for Truman State, which is called Pittering Pattering. And it poaches from the piece that I'd written for Troy called The Cruel Waters. And it poaches from a piece I'd written for Florida State called Sparkle Frog. And it uses all of these sort of things that I had done in one way there and thought, okay, well, I can put these together in new and exciting ways and use those as a kind of vocabulary. So it was really fun, and I think in the end, it made for a really strong piece. And I thought, well, I'm going to be done writing for percussion for a while, and now I have a new tight deadline for this November to write a concerto for 4 percussionists with wind ensemble that's going to premiere at the College Band Directors National Conference. So again, coming right back in with the percussion instruments and band and trying to find new and interesting things to do for that.
Wow, very cool. It's great. Hey, so Megan, I think you have a little something about the practice journal from Liquid Drum.
Yeah, well, don't worry, Adam. We are going to be practicing because Todd Meehan has come out with this new practice journal. He had a Kickstarter. How many of you guys has anyone picked up a copy of this yet or heard about it?
I don't have mine yet.
Yeah, I actually missed the boat on the Kickstarter because I was in Ghana, but I ordered one once it came out, and I just got it in the mail. So I thought I would just do a quick review on it. It's divided into 7 different sections that are important dates, planning assignments, practice and work, tallies, notes, and music. And I think it's cool because you might have remembered I reported on the bullet journal one time, and that's kind of my main method of organization. Right. But I'm going to give this a try, and I think it might be really cool because we talk on the podcast a lot about managing email, right, and balancing our time between practicing and doing all this administration that is often part of our jobs, right? So this middle section, I guess you can tell it was designed by someone who's doing both of those things. The main body of the journal is called Practice and Work. And I saw Todd had posted like an example on his Instagram, and he's got on there practice and stuff, but then also like email. So you can track how much time you're spending on that and maybe be able to balance it a little bit better. If you're having a challenge with that. The other thing I kind of like that the composers might like is that there's a section for music, which is just blank staff paper at the end. And the subtitle of that section is flesh out musical ideas, compositional sketches, licks, etc. So just kind of a place to jot down ideas as they come to you. And then finally, there's a section called tallies, where you can kind of tally up how much time you're spending on things. I would think in the goal of figuring out, you know, how you need to readjust things, whether that be practicing, email, working out, or whatever you want to be a part of your daily life. And there's places where you can kind of check or write how many hours you're spending and for each day. So I think that's kind of cool too, to see how much you're getting done on the weekend versus during certain days of the week. And the section I like is that there's an important dates section and planning section where you can kind of put in where your recitals, auditions, all those things are. So I just sent the link to my students this semester. I'm not requiring them to buy it, but strongly suggesting that it might be a good thing to check out to get more organized. So I'll let you guys know after I'm a few weeks in, but looks promising.
Cool. Thanks, Megan. Yeah, it's been really fun to watch this whole thing unfold, starting all the way from the Kickstarter and now all the way to its production and I guess now distribution and sales. And it's just, it's fun watching everything Todd does online. It's just, entertaining yet really, really good.
Right. So, you're like, is this a joke? Wait, this is not a joke. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Hey, Megs, does it have suggestions for like how to organize something, or is it literally just kind of like a book that provides you with tools and just says, okay, use these however you want?
The latter. It seems pretty open-ended. There's one about section that kind of suggests some things, but he does say the sections are not meant to be rigid boundaries within which to work. Rather, think of them as suggested frameworks that allow for a degree of structure and organization to your practice path. So similar to the bullet journal, it's very open-ended, and it just kind of I mean, for example, in the main section, practice and work, there are for each day there are blanks for times, to-dos, material practice, and then reflection on that. So that's all. So I guess it's structure. It's more definitely more structured than a bullet journal, but there's not information about how to structure your practice routine or something. It's more of a blank canvas for that.
Right. Gotcha.
Or place the log. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, you guys know what meltdown means.
Yay!
Thanks, Megan. Yeah, so speed trivia time. The score is Ben and Megan are tied, and Laurel is up by 2. Oh, shoot, but she had to leave the room.
I'll play for Laurel.
That strategically happened.
Okay, yeah, Laurel's at a severe disadvantage right now because she's got a baby in her hands and had to leave the room. Maybe I'll wait a minute. Okay, guys, so I've got a few questions for you, and here we go. So
wait, are we typing me?
Oh, I've already got it typed.
Ben!
That's what I said. What happened?
I know. I don't know what else.
Got hit enter.
The lag keeps getting screwed. You can tell you what, you can all type me and have it just ready to go.
Exactly. Am I allowed to do this?
You're totally allowed. You can steal. Yeah, Adam, you're more than welcome to steal these from my friends.
All the Miami grads are thinking ahead.
Okay, here we go. So I actually just pulled this question up because of Megan's last topic. So this at Percussion guest is currently investigating the effectiveness of practice journaling when comparing digital sources such as apps versus analog pen and paper sources such as Todd Meehan's practice journal. Who is this guest?
I think Colin Hill.
Is actually James Doyle.
Oh, yeah. I would have also missed it.
Yeah, I know Colin Hill has done a lot with that, but James said he was going to look through and try to actually figure out with his various students what's the effectiveness of digital versus analog.
Are these that. Jeopardy rules? Does that mean I have minus one now?
Excuse me, what is minus one?
That sounds like too many points of sophistication. It's hard enough as it is. I don't know if I can keep up with negative numbers as well. Okay, so next question. In Ghana and the Dogara culture, when a baby is born, there is a sign that the child is, quote, born to play the xylophone. What is that sign?
If they come out of the mother's womb with their fist clenched.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, so if you listen to Megan's interview with Jerome Balsob on episode 155, that is exactly right. Ben. Good. Better typed than said. Okay, last question. So, Brian, this was something from your episode. I pulled this up since you were going to be joining us today. So, when creating the first Xbox game console, the Microsoft company embedded hidden sounds within the hard drive to supposedly scare or at least tease any potential listeners or hackers that were going to dive into the hard drive and try to hack the system. It wanted to fool or tease them into thinking that this was the Xbox was a piece of otherworldly technology. From what federal agency did they acquire these spooky and mysterious sounds?
NASA.
Yeah, good. All right, so your minus one went to plus one.
That's a serious throwback.
I know.
Yeah, no good memory. Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, that's y'all's quiz for the day. Nice work.
Good times.
Yeah. Well, you guys, thanks so much for doing 160. And Adam Silverman, really great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me here.
Okay, everybody, we will catch you next time. The next guest is the composer Jesse Marino. So we'll see you next week.
Awesome. Bye.
Bye. Bye.